You know, our country's National Park Service has been called America's best idea. And I love our national parks. I love getting to visit places like the Great Smoky Mountains or Zion National Park or most recently Yosemite National Park. My family's, we've even been to the Dry Tortugas, which is one of the most remote national parks. But I love getting out into nature. And I especially love going on long hikes, seeing mountains, enjoying valleys along riverbeds, through canyons. But every time we go out for a hike, we have to remember that we run the risk of getting lost. And there really are two ways of getting lost when you're hiking. You can leave the trail that you know you're supposed to follow, or you can follow the wrong trail, thinking it's the right trail. Now, leaving the trail is reckless. It basically says, I know the way to go. I don't need a map. I don't need a compass. I don't need even a marked trail. Following the wrong trail seems right for a bit, but it's not going to get you where you want to go. You know, we all face a similar danger spiritually. Getting lost from understanding the true mercy, grace, and love of our God. We either leave the trail of God's mercy or we follow a different trail of our own righteousness. One may seem better, but both are destructive and they alienate us from the God who loves us so much. Today, we're going to look at a great story about two sons and a father. And it's a story that Jesus actually told. It might be the most famous story he ever told, the most famous parable. It's traditionally called the parable of the prodigal son. In some translations, it's called the parable of the lost son. And it comes to us from Luke chapter 15. But to set the story up, we need to know the context. Luke 15, verse 1 and 2, this is how the chapter begins. It says, "Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to him," that's Jesus. "And the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, 'This man receives sinners and eats with them.'" The religious leaders of the Jewish people look at Jesus, who's supposed to be this great rabbi, and they're upset because he's not following the protocol of a good Jewish religious leader. Rabbis condemned the behavior of people like tax collectors and the so-called sinners, often prostitutes and others who would cheat and lie and find their way around the laws of God. And so rabbis didn't associate with them at all. They certainly wouldn't eat with them. But Jesus does things differently. And in response to their grumbles, he doesn't debate, but he begins to tell stories, parables. He tells a story about a man who has 100 sheep and he leaves the 99 to chase after the one lost sheep. He tells another story about a woman who has 10 silver coins, but she turns her entire house over to find the one coin that she's lost. And then she throws a party once she's found the one lost coin. Now, we know those stories. If you grew up in church, you've heard both of those stories. But when you look at them, logically, they're ridiculous. I mean, who leaves 99 sheep to get one lost sheep? It doesn't add up. The risk is too great, leaving the 99 at risk to go get the one. Who spends money to throw a party because you found one silver coin? Doesn't make sense. But this is the setup for the third story about a father and two sons. Luke 15, verse 11, Jesus said, "There was a man who had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of property that's coming to me.' And the father divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine rose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread? But I perish here with hunger. I will arise and go to my father. I will say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. The first section of this story, it focuses on the younger son, who at this time is probably 18, 19 years old. You remember what it's like to be 18 or 19? You're impetuous. You think you've got everything figured out. And so he has a plan. And his plan is a rude plan. He asks for his share of the inheritance from his father, which, as the younger son, would have been roughly one-third of the total portion of the father's wealth. And the implication is that the father is very wealthy. And yet, that inheritance, as is the case with all inheritances, is not supposed to be given to the children until the father has died. And so this request from the younger son is basically saying, hey, Dad, let's pretend you're dead and give me what you would give me then. Give me it now. I want it now. It's crazy how rude this request is. How heartbreaking it must have been for the father. The second use of the word property in this section sometimes is translated as wealth. But it's the Greek word bios. It's where we get the prefix bio, as in biology or biography. And it means life. The father is dividing his very life, the sum total of his life's work. He's giving one-third of it to his son because he wants it now. And what does he do? He gets as far away as he can from the father. He goes to a Gentile area. We know it's a Gentile area because they're tending pigs. And Jewish people don't eat pigs. They don't tend pigs. They think people who tend pigs are ceremonially unclean. This son has gone to a place without the same moral scruples as his Jewish hometown. And what does he do? He parties. And he parties and he parties. The Greek word is asotos. And it's only used here in the New Testament. And it means he has a riot. In 1999, music promoters had this bright idea. They decided they wanted to try to recreate the so-called Summer of Peace, Love, and Happiness after the 1969 Woodstock Festival. It was 30 years later, and they wanted to stage Woodstock 99, a music festival. There are two problems with this idea. They severely overhyped why a drug-addled, promiscuous music festival should be emulated 30 years later. And secondly, they failed to understand that with corporate bottom lines as motivation, out in a very hot tarmac in New York, that they could even remotely recreate the organic nature of the 1969 festival. And so what resulted at Woodstock 99 were stories of assaults, price gouging, and literally firebombing riots. It all started as a big party and it ended in violence. That's what happens when autonomous, unchecked desire leads the way. It's destructive and it's quick. This is what the young son experiences. In a short time, he is beyond broke. And the famine comes. The very happiness that he thought was going to be fulfilled in the promises of the desires of the flesh, they were found weak, wanting, fleeting, utterly void. He's left in the most unholy, unclean of places in a pigsty, longing to eat the food barely suitable for the animals he is tending to. That's where he's at. And then he has this epiphany. He thinks back to his father's household, and they always have plenty. Even the servants have plenty. He's going to go home. He's going to humble himself. He's going to work for his father, and maybe he can repay the debt that he's owed. He rehearses the speech, and he goes back to his father's house. Now remember, Jesus is telling this story in the context of Pharisees and scribes. For the Pharisees and scribes, this is where they would want the story to end. the young son, the promiscuous, law-breaking son, he's gotten what he deserves, and now he has to put his tail between his legs. This is where the story went in, except maybe they would add the time when the young son actually returns to face his father, and the father gives him a stern beating of unforgiveness. The moral clause of the contract has been broken, so the boy's out. In fact, there were other rabbinical stories floating around during that time where wayward sons did face that sort of wrath. But that's not the story Jesus tells. As the story continues in Luke 15, it says, "And the younger son arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. And bring the fatted calf and kill it and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead. And he's alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate." Now, I want to make it clear. The younger son's motivation is not pure. He doesn't come back to his father because he knows he was wrong in the first place. He's repenting because he's hungry. He's felt the temporal weight of his consequences. But he's going to come back anyway. And even before he can get to the house, the father sees him a long way off. The idea is that the father has been hoping beyond hope that he would see his son. And then the father breaks into action. He does something that would shock the audience that Jesus is talking to. The father runs. He's been watching for his son, and he runs out to meet him. Breaks into a sprint. What does that mean? That means he has to hike up his robes, expose his legs to get the strides in that he needs. For us in our day, that doesn't seem like a big deal. Out there on Lake Hollingsworth, there are people running the lake right now. I can see through the window and see people running. We don't think anything of it. But old men in that time, they didn't run. Especially wealthy landowners. Running was something for young Gentile, Roman, Greek athletes to do, not prim and proper, wealthy Jewish men. That was beneath them, undignified. But the father sees a formerly dead and lost son, and he puts aside all dignity. He goes even further. He runs and he embraces his son. Literally, it means he falls on his neck. And he begins to kiss his son. The emotional outpouring is extreme, and it's undignified in every conceivable way. And before the son can even get out his carefully planned speech, the father not only receives him, but restores him. Bring the best robe. The best robe in the house would have been the father's own robe. Put the signet ring on his finger. A sign that the son has been restored to the authority of the family. He's not a servant. Gives him sandals. Servants didn't wear sandals, but the members of the household did. And the father throws a party with the best food and the biggest celebration because what was lost was found. What had died and been brought back to life. You know, when Caleb was very young, Jules and I had to decide how we were going to discipline him when he did something wrong. Now, for the record, we were not a spanking, closed-fisted sort of family. But we were also not free-range parents either. There were definitely rules and there were definitely consequences. But one of the things that I, as a dad, had to really think about when disciplining Caleb and then later on Hanny was my physical posture when talking to them. You know, so many parents, when they're disciplining their kids, they approach with crossed arm dissatisfaction. scowling-faced, foot-tapping, quick with angry yelling, sometimes even abusive words. I've heard it and I've seen it. And I'll be honest with you. My default as a dad, when I'm disciplining my children, is crossed-armed, scowling-faced, stern, demanding obedience. That's my default. But that's not the posture I wanted to have. Because that's not the posture of our God. That's not the posture of the Father here. He's not cross-armed, toe-tapping, scowl-faced. He's flat-out running, putting aside dignity, embracing and kissing his child. There's no social boundary that's going to separate him from his son. Even though the son has squandered everything he's been given, the Father restores him and celebrates him. But this is not really the parable of the lost son. This is a parable of two sons. There's an older son. In verse 25, it says, "Now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, 'Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fatted calf, because he has received him back safe and sound.' But the older son was angry, and he refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him. But he answered his father, 'Look, these many years I've served you, and I've never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But with this son of yours came, who's devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him?' And the father said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and he's found.'" You know, the older son has literally been out in the field working his father's land, while a party for his no good, lazy, philandering brother goes on inside. And the dad's not only welcomed that younger brother in, but he's given him the full rights of being his son, meaning now the younger son has a new share of the now reduced inheritance. Can you imagine the anger of the older son? You got to believe he's going to be angry. I know some of you can relate to this. You've got a sibling who never seems to get their life together, and you have it all figured out. But somehow, you're still on the outside. But notice this. The older son is still the one putting the distance between himself and his father. His anger is based on what he thinks he is owed from his father. He's saying to his dad, "I've earned my place in this house, and you won't give it to me." But the father's posture is the same as the younger son. He goes out to meet the older son. He entreats him, it says. Literally, he begs him to come inside and celebrate, to be part of the celebration. He reminds his older son that the younger son was dead, but he's now alive. And that's where the story ends. There's no mention of what the older son does. No mention, does he come and join the party? Does he turn back in anger? We don't know. But we have to remember why Jesus is telling the story in the first place. He's telling the story in response to the grumbling Jewish leaders, because Jesus is receiving tax collectors and sinners. These are people who are upset because Jesus is associating with promiscuous people, evil people, cheating people. The lesson for the Pharisees is the same for us. There are two ways to get lost as a hiker. And there are two ways to get lost in our relationship to the Lord. There is the younger son way, and there's the older son way. But both are alienated from the Father. And we're in danger from being alienated from the Lord. Tim Keller writes about this story in Prodigal God. And he writes that the way of the younger son is the one that tries to find wholeness and fulfillment in, quote, self-discovery. Keller writes of the younger son, "This paradigm holds that individuals must be free to pursue their own goals and self-actualization regardless of custom and convention." The younger son way leaves the trail. It leaves the trail for a life of selfishness and comfort-seeking, vacation-chasing, hobby-stacking, and addiction. It's a way to get lost. But the older son is lost too. It's just that he takes the wrong trail. It's a trail of self-righteousness. As Tim Keller calls it, it's a trail of moral conformity. Keller writes, "His unspoken demand is, I have never disobeyed you. Now you have to do things in my life the way I want them done." The older son attempts salvation, happiness, joy apart from God because he thinks he doesn't need the grace. He's earned it. The fact of the matter is, we all fall into one of these two ways of getting lost. And the truth is, most of us, we're pretty good at being both sons, just in different contexts. I mean, look at the habits and the tendencies of your heart. Look at our attitudes towards others. Are we a sinner on Saturday and a saint on Sunday? I know ultra-judgmental elders who look sideways at someone with tattoos and piercings in the hallways of the church. It's the same person who sees no issue throwing back three or four drinks on the 19th hole on Saturday. The self-discovering bohemian has very strict guidelines about what true mercy should look like, and then they judge the traditionalists who follow convention. We all kind of can fall into those traps of lostness. But the answer to these two ways of self-salvation is not some middle way. Because our tendency is to say, okay, let's find a middle way. But there's not a middle way. The only way is Jesus. Because the gospel isn't about conforming to some moral code. Jesus doesn't die to make us good people. That's not the gospel. The gospel is about realizing that all our attempts at self-discovery or self-righteousness are wrong. The older son and the younger son are not worthy to be called son, and yet the Father still receives us because of Jesus. Not only does the Father receive us, the Lord comes running, begging us to come in. God throws off all dignity he's due in Jesus to become a servant to humanity, to the point of dying on the cross. And this story, it calls us to look at our hearts and know that our need for Jesus is great. No matter which way we get lost, we need Jesus to chase after us, to rescue us, to find us, to save us. The way of grace is about giving up our preconceived ideas of identity and happiness and accepting his invitation to come in. Jesus' grace is magnificent. It's undignified. And he's calling us to accept that grace and mercy. Will we get on his path and answer his call? Will you join me in prayer? Gracious and holy God, we admit that we have a terrible tendency of leaving you. We leave you behind to follow our own desires and selfish motivations. We leave you by thinking we can put you under obligation by doing all the things that look right and sound right, joining all the right clubs, and Lord, even the temptation of thinking our church attendance and tithes will put you under obligation to bless us and bless our lives. Forgive us when we leave you, when we put our own self-salvation above our relationship to you. Lord, help us to be grateful and joy-filled by the undignified grace of Jesus Christ. Help us to embrace that and then to reflect that and with joy receive those who do the same, no matter what they look like, no matter what their backgrounds. Remembering that in all things, you want us to be your children. We pray this in Jesus' name and for his sake. Amen.